Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicview.com, where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly with your questions at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. In the world of beekeeping, neonicotinoids have maintained the spotlight as the scientific evidence continues to grow regarding the decline of the world's bee population. Neonicotinoids are defined by the EPA as a class of insecticides with a common mode of action that affects the central nervous system of insects, causing paralysis and death. All of the neonicotinoids were registered after 1984 and were not subject to re-registration. Some uncertainties have been identified since their initial registration regarding the potential environmental fate and effects of neonicotinoid pesticides, particularly as they relate to pollinators. Data suggests that neonicotinoid residues can accumulate in pollen and nectar of treated plants and may represent a potential exposure to pollinators. Adverse effects data as well as bee kill incidents have also been reported, highlighting the potential direct and or indirect effects of neonicotinoid pesticides. Therefore, among other refinements to ecological risk assessment during registration review, the EPA will consider potential effects of the neonicotinoids to honeybees and other pollinating insects. Now, Dr. Dave Goulson, professor of biological sciences at the University of Stirling, and his team have conducted new research titled Neonicotinoid Pesticide Reduces Bumblebee Colony Growth and Queen Production. Here's part of the abstract. Growing evidence for declines in bee populations has caused great concern because of the valuable ecosystem services they provide. Neonicotinoid insecticides have been implicated in these declines because they occur at trace levels in the nectar and pollen of crop plants. In this special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my co-host Tom Theobald and I will be joined today by Dr. Goulson, who will be discussing his research. So I would first like to welcome to the show my co-host Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hi, Joan, and hello, Professor Goulson.
And welcome, Professor Dave Goulson.
Good afternoon.
Professor, could you kindly tell our audience about yourself and the research that you focus on?
I've been working on bumblebees rather than honeybees for about the last 20 years, mainly focused on trying to understand more about their biology and why they've been declining, which many of them have for quite some time, 50 or 60 years. My interest in pesticides is much more recent. I became involved about 6 years ago we set up a charity called the Bumblebee Conservation Trust to conserve bumblebees, which is a membership-based charity. And that the members of the trust started to raise this issue with us, saying they'd heard that neonicotinoids were killing bees and what were we going to do about it. And I looked at the evidence and wasn't really convinced that we knew the answers. So we, a couple of years ago, took the decision to try and find the answers for ourselves.
Thank you. Can you explain to our audience about bumblebees? Are bumblebees a protected species?
There are lots of different species, actually. There are about 250 species of bumblebee in the world. So we've got about 25 in the UK, and I think you have about 60 in North America, although I could be slightly out there. Some of them are very rare. One or two of them have gone extinct. In fact, a few years ago, the most recent bumblebee extinction was in California. Franklin's bumblebee hasn't now been seen for about 6 years and is almost certainly gone. So some of them have declined very badly over a number of years and probably due to a number of different causes. But given their importance as pollinators of lots of crops. There are lots of things like, say, tomatoes, which are rather poorly pollinated by honeybees, and which are much better pollinated by bumblebees, then we should be really concerned that our bumblebees are disappearing.
Thank you. In regards to the actual research, can you talk about the specific neonicotinoids that were used?
We used imidacloprid, which is the most widely used of the neonicotinoids globally. It's apparently the second most widely used agrochemical in the world after glyphosate.
Can you talk about the effects of the exposure on colony development as well as the production of drones and queens?
Yeah, sure. The big focus in Europe has really been on use of neonicotinoids in oilseed rape. You call it canola, which is one of the main flowering crops which are treated with neonicotinoids in Europe and also on your side of the Atlantic. We don't have, it's a bit too cold for sunflowers, and we don't have much corn in Britain, but we do have lots of oilseed rape, and pretty much 100% of it in the UK is treated as a seed with neonicotinoids, which means that bees feed on the pollen and nectar and are exposed throughout the flowering period. And the big question was, what harm was that doing? The doses were probably below those that would actually directly and swiftly kill bees. But there was sort of growing evidence that this sort of chronic exposure over a number of weeks was impairing the ability of bees to learn and to navigate. And it seemed to us that if that was where the big effects lay, then lab studies or cage studies weren't really going to reveal very much, because if it's all about bees being able to navigate, then in the natural world, that both honeybees and bumblebees, they have to find flowers that might be miles from their nest, and they have to locate the flowers, and they have to work out how to get the pollen and nectar from them, navigate their way back to the nest, and then do that over and over again for weeks. In fact, it's amazing that they do it at all, and clearly anything that impairs their navigational ability could have a really profound effect in the field, but you wouldn't notice it at all if you were keeping your bees in a cage in the lab. They're hardly going to get lost. So we felt that we needed to do an experiment that actually exposed bees to neonics and then allowed them to forage naturally, or forced them to forage naturally, to see whether that exposure to the neonics had an impact on the colony development subsequently, when bees were living outside and having to gather food as they naturally would from flowers. So that's essentially what we tried to mimic in our experiment. And when we started, I must admit, I had no idea whether we were going to find anything at all. As I mentioned earlier, we set out studying this partly because we were being kind of badgered by people who at the time I thought were possibly rather extremist in their anti-pesticide views. But it's become such a controversial topic that if we'd found no effect at all, I think it would have been very interesting, and it might have allowed us to say to people, actually, you know, this isn't a big deal. But what we found, in fact, was that it was a big deal, that our bumblebee nests produced 85% fewer queens at the end of the year than the control nest. So when they were exposed for 2 weeks to the amounts of neonicotinoids that they would get if they were feeding on a rape field, essentially the nests performed much more poorly. They grew more slowly and produced, as I say, 85% fewer queens, which is pretty disastrous for bumblebees. They're different to honeybees in that they have an annual life cycle. The nests don't survive the winter. The only things that survive the winter are the new queens. So if you're knocking out 85% of them, then you're basically knocking out 85% of the whole population. And if that's happening on a big scale in farming, in farmland, then we should be really worried about it.
Thank you. Exactly how much land was used to conduct these tests? I'm just curious.
So part of the problem we had when we set about doing this, in an ideal world, we'd have got our bumblebee nests and we'd have put them next to treated fields of oilseed rape or untreated fields in the way that a nest would naturally be exposed. The problem we have or had is that there aren't any untreated fields in the United Kingdom. 100% of rape of oilseed rape is pre-treated. We couldn't put our nests next to clean fields. And in fact, if we'd had the resources, we could perhaps have planted our own field of untreated oilseed rape. But even then, unless we owned the whole landscape, we wouldn't have been able to remove all the neonicotinoids because all the neighbours would have still been using them. And bees obviously don't go where you tell them. They'll forage where they fancy. They fly a long way. And so essentially, it's almost impossible to have a controlled treatment, a place where you can put your bee nests that aren't going to be exposed to neonicotinoids. So the only way we could come up with to solve that problem is to do the exposure part of the experiment in the lab. This is something I must say we've been criticized for. The agrochemical industry have said, oh, this is absolute nonsense. It's a lab study. It's not representative of what goes on in the field. What we did was we got our young bumblebee nests, kept them in the lab for 2 weeks, and we fed them on pollen and nectar, which had been laced with imidacloprid at levels that precisely mimics concentrations found in nectar and pollen of oilseed rape crops in the field. And then after 2 weeks, we put the nests outside in a place where we thought there were as few neonicotinoids as we could possibly find, but I can't guarantee there weren't some somewhere. And we then tracked what happened to the nests. So we had control nests that had just been fed healthy pollen and nectar and the treated nests that had been fed the laced pollen and nectar. So in fact, how much land did we use? Well, only we didn't have our own, we don't have an agricultural field station. We used whatever area of land the bees chose to forage over, but it actually was a fairly simple experiment to do. And just required us to have somewhere where we could put the nest outside and leave them to get on with it.
Professor Goulson, one of the, as I understand it, one of the criticisms raised by the chemical industry was that you weren't using field-relevant doses, and you've just touched upon that a little. Could you explain in a little more detail just what the dosing level was and how it compares to what they might encounter in the field?
Yeah, sure. And that's a strange criticism, which frankly is just nonsense. So the concentrations we used were taken directly from a published paper by a research group which had measured concentrations of neonicotinoids in nectar and pollen of oilseed rape in a commercial situation. And so the concentrations were, it was 0.7 parts per billion in the nectar and 6 parts per billion in the pollen. That's what we fed to our bees. Now, there have been a range of other studies of concentrations of neonics in pollen and nectar of oilseed rape and maize and sunflowers and various other crops. And certainly the concentrations we used are well within the range that are commonly found, routinely found in crops. In fact, there are some studies which have found levels as high as 50 parts per billion in pollen in particular, of commercial crops. So to say that we used levels that were too high or unrealistically high is just basically untrue.
One of the things that we have found with the honeybee is that these neonicotinoids have multiple modes of action, not the least of which appears to be a severe compromising of their immune system. Did your research reveal any of those conditions?
We haven't investigated that. I mean, clearly anything that stresses bees is likely to interact with other stressors in the environment. And of course, it's the real world is pretty complicated. There are lots of things that affect bee health. I have never claimed that neonics are the only problem that bees face. That would obviously be a ridiculous thing to claim. They constantly face a barrage of parasites that attack them, both bumblebees and honeybees. they're also exposed to a whole bunch of other pesticides. And one of the biggest problems that certainly bumblebees face in agricultural landscapes these days is there are hardly any flowers, so many nests are close to starving most of the time. And I think it's the combination of all these things that's really hitting bees, that they might be able to cope with neonicotinoids if everything else was fine, but everything else isn't fine. And so bee nests are being stressed from all sides. We haven't worked on it ourselves, but there is good evidence that shows that if exposure to pesticides increases susceptibility to disease. And it makes common sense that if something's being stressed from one source, it's the same in humans. If you're stressed, then you're more likely to catch a cold or whatever. And hardly surprising that bees are much the same in that sense.
Do you have any additional research either planned or underway?
Yeah, there are lots of aspects to this that need more exploration. Thankfully, I have got funding for a 3-year project that kicks off in April, which is going to be looking in much more detail at what happens with bumblebees specifically. And one of the big questions we have at this stage is that people have measured the concentrations in nectar and pollen of treated crops. And so our experiment previously was based on the assumption that that's what bees would be exposed to. But actually, we don't know very well what bumblebees actually consume in the wild. So in terms of what concentrations of neonicotinoids they bring back to their nest, which is a big question, particularly, for example, because there are lots of uses of neonicotinoids which aren't well documented. For example, in gardens in the UK and I believe in the US, the main insecticides available to gardeners to control greenfly or whatever are neonicotinoid based. And of course, gardeners don't have any training. They're likely to put on more than they should or use them inappropriately or whatever. We can get hold of no statistics on how much is used in urban areas. So there are things like that where bees may be being exposed to neonicotinoids in ways that we don't know. The only way to get a handle on that is to put bee nests out into different landscapes and actually quantify the concentrations of the pesticides in the pollen and nectar being gathered by the bees. So that's one of the first things we're going to do in this new project. And hopefully it'll enable us to provide a kind of definitive answer for the UK, at least, as to how much of these compounds these bumblebees are exposed to.
Just out of curiosity, were there any observations as far as the impact on birds, especially with hummingbirds?
I'm not aware of any research on hummingbirds. It's certainly true that the toxicity to vertebrates seems to be a lot lower than the toxicity to insects in particular, and some crustaceans seem to be very, very susceptible to neonicotinoids, that they're phenomenally toxic to them, much less so to vertebrates generally. So perhaps you would predict that hummingbirds wouldn't be affected. There is an aspect to this that I think is quite interesting, which I don't think has been properly explored, and I, as an entomologist, I'm not perhaps the best person to do it, but because of the low toxicity to vertebrates, everyone has assumed that they're not really at risk. But it's rather overlooking the fact that there are quite a lot of rodents and birds that live in farmland that eat seed. And it's well known that when a farmer is drilling his field, that a small proportion of the seed that he drills gets left on the soil surface. It's either spilt while he's loading the tractor, or because of unevenness in the ground, the drill doesn't get it under the soil surface. And of course, there are lots of birds and mice and so on that will quickly hoover up any spilled seed. And the seeds themselves have enormous concentrations. I mean, obviously, they've been coated with neonicotinoids. So one corn seed has about a milligram typically of neonicotinoid on it, which is essentially from the toxicity studies that were done to assess whether these compounds were safe, would suggest that something like a mouse only needs to eat a couple of seeds of maize to receive a lethal dose. Similarly, farmland birds, similar order of magnitude. They only need to eat a handful of seeds, and it could easily kill them. So actually, there's the potential here for quite widespread impacts on vertebrates that, just as far as I can tell, haven't been investigated at all.
Dr. Goulson, just recently, the 30,000-member Scottish Wildlife Fund has weighed in on this question and called for a moratorium on the neonics, and the Scottish government seems to be very reluctant to step up to this problem, along with many other governments. Do you see any changes on the horizon?
I wish I could tell you. I'm afraid I don't have a crystal ball, and predicting what politicians will do is never easy. There does seem to be a lot of reluctance to do anything as far as politicians are concerned. There have been a few bans or partial bans from other European countries, but nothing in Britain at all so far. And the bans that have been introduced are I think, more political than anything else, and not really effective because in most cases they've banned a single compound while allowing others to be used, or they've banned their use on a single crop while allowing them to be widely used elsewhere on other crops. So they're not really going to achieve anything. As to whether the Scottish government or the British government will take action, to be fair to them, they're certainly at least interested. There's an inquiry going on in Westminster MPs, a thing called the Environmental Audit Committee, has been interviewing people, including myself and representatives of the agrochemical industry, through the autumn, and that's continuing into the new year. What the outcome of that will be, I haven't got a clue at this stage. I'm eagerly awaiting it. But if I had to guess, I'd be surprised if they introduce any kind of moratorium. I think partly because it's very easy for the agrochemical industry to scaremonger and say that if there was a moratorium, that this would threaten farmers' livelihoods, that crop yields would drop, that food security would be threatened, there'd be all sorts of economic ramifications. In fact, the evidence for that is more or less non-existent. But you can imagine politicians being rather scared by that prospect and therefore fighting shy of actually making a decision.
How has the rest of the scientific community responded to your research?
Oddly enough, I mean, the scientific community is pretty well united on this. It's a bit like climate change, if you like. I mean, certainly all the people I know that work on bees and pesticides are pretty much universally in agreement that the levels that bees are being exposed to in farmland are enough to cause harm. So I don't think there's any great controversy there.
Thank you. Professor Goulson, can you share with our audience any research projects that you're looking for funding for so that perhaps if there are any listeners out there that would generously support your efforts, they may do so?
Well, I've become interested in the wider ramifications of this. I mentioned that we've got funding for more work on bumblebees, but I'm increasingly of the opinion that this story may be much wider than bees. I mentioned birds and possible impacts on birds, but actually if you were to try and think of a group of organisms that are most likely to have been badly affected by these pesticides, then it would probably be the soil invertebrates. There's very good evidence that these compounds, once they're in soil, last for an enormous length of time. The majority of the active ingredient put on a seed coating doesn't go into the crop at all. In the region of 98% of it goes into the soil rather than the plant it's targeted at. And the half-life of these things can be in the order of years. We're not quite sure. It seems to vary between studies, but certainly it's sufficiently long that they accumulate over time, and there's very good evidence that if a farmer uses them year on year, the levels in soil rise steadily to alarmingly high levels, 50 parts per billion, 100 parts per billion, which is way above the levels which are known to kill bees or pest insects or whatever. And so there's a real concern in my mind that we're having a huge impact on the soil invertebrates, things like worms and springtails and so on, that are really vital in maintaining soil health. And obviously that's absolutely vital to the future of farming, that we look after soil. And I don't think there's really been any proper investigation of what impact the ongoing accumulation of neonics in farmland soils is having on soil health and the communities of vital organisms that live there. And yet they're the things that actually are probably most exposed to very high levels of these things. So that's one area I'd love to get more funding and get some research going.
And how can our audience reach out to you to support your efforts?
I'm very easy to find.
Yes, you are.
If you stick my name into Google and stick Bumblebee as well, you'll find my homepage very quickly. And that will give you my email address if you're so inclined to get in touch. If anyone can help, then I'd love to hear from them.
Thank you so much. And Professor Goulson, I really appreciate that you took the time to come on the show today. It has been wonderful speaking to you about your research, and I wish you all the best with your future research and different efforts in order to bring awareness about the impacts of the neonicotinoids.
I'd like to thank you not only for the work that you've done, but for your willingness to speak out.
That's a pleasure.
Thank you so much, folks, for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Thank you and have a great day.